17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. AJ at a descent. Air control both auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
My guest on Cosmic Perspective Radio has a PhD in physics from UCLA, has attended Harvard Business School, attended the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is a retired colonel in the Marine Corps, U.S. Marine Corps Reserve, an author, the recipient of the NASA Distinguished Service Medal, and Apollo 7 astronaut. Colonel Walter Cunningham, thanks for joining us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to join you.
Is there any top-tier school that you haven't attended?
Well, I've got an interesting college background. I didn't even start college until I was 25.
You went from straight from high school into the military?
Yeah, that's right. I went from the high school into the military and had a what was actually the kind of the beginning of a excellent career, actually, in the Marine Corps fighter squadrons and that kind of activity. But it was also, it brought me to the realization that college would be a good thing for me to do. So I transferred into the reserve squadron. So I ended up with about 23 or 24 years in the military, counting the reserve activity and the active duty, and started college as a 25-year-old, and I was in the last year of my doctorate. I didn't complete it. I was in the last year of my doctorate in physics when NASA selected me as an astronaut.
All of us that are old enough to remember, and that's including me, Alan Shepard's historic flight, first American in space. Would you please tell us your experience when Alan Shepard took that historic flight?
Well, I hope you can take the full language on that when I listened to it. I was back in college then. As I told you, I started college when I was about 25, and I was working part-time at the RAND Corporation, and it was May 5th, 1961. So I was driving to work, and I worked part-time, full-time student. Never was able to get any kind of a treatment with money that would reduce things. So I was working part-time all the time. I was working half-time at the RAND Corporation, which was majoring in physics and stuff. So that morning, I was driving to work a little before 7 out in California where I was at. That was a little before 10 down at the Cape. And as I was listening, I was on the radio, had the radio on, and there was the Alan Shepard countdown for the first Mercury launch, first American man to get up above 60 miles. And when I got down to the last few minutes on that, I couldn't even drive anymore. I was into it so much and so wrapped up with it on the launch that I pulled over the side of the road. And in those days, they weren't loaded with homes. There was kind of an empty piece of the road. So I pulled over, listed, and got down to the last 3, 2, 1, liftoff. And boy, I heard this voice screaming out around me up there, "You lucky SOB." And then I looked around and realized it was me doing the screaming. So I was tremendously impressed with that liftoff and the flight. And I didn't realize until, probably some months later, I started to realize that that was what convinced me that that was what I was going to do, if I could, in my career. And 2.5 years later, I was sharing an office with that same Alan Shepard.
That's amazing to think that that all happened in that short period of time.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate. We had many people that were candidates in our group, as a matter of fact. It was the third group of astronauts. And many of those candidates had applied before and not been successful. In fact, some of them had been there considered for the first group and the second group, and now they were in for the third group. So I feel fortunate. But I think it was partly because NASA was beginning to place a little bit more emphasis on education and background and qualifications to do these things. And since I was a science major at the time and with a lot of flight time, I think at the time I already was up above 2,000 hours of pilot time. I was fortunate at that time, but some of it was because NASA was beginning to change and open their mind up to who all they would get in. And they selected 14 of us, and 6 or 7 of us had not been to test pilot school.
The first time I met you, that was at the Explorers Club in New York City a few years back, and you told me that your lucky number was 13, and you mentioned there were 14 astronauts selected. Can you tell our listeners why that 13 is a lucky number for you?
Yeah, I've never thought about it since that time. That's the only time I was really fortunate with 13. But years later, I learned that before we were called and notified, actually, that at the time they were announcing Deke Slayton, who was the head of astronaut office and all astronaut activities at the time. And Deke went over the list of people that had been selected. We started off, I think, with about 700 and some qualified applicants, and by the time they got down to the towards the tail end where we were all taking physicals, there was 34 of us left, and we all knew at the time that no more than half of us would make it in. And Deke was presenting this to the staff there at the Johnson Space Center, and it wasn't called the Johnson Space Center yet at that time. That's where he was, and a friend of mine who was the head of public relations. I had met him probably 3 or 4 months earlier, and he had been unable to make the beginning of that presentation. So as he comes in, Deke says, and that's the end of my list here. And at that time, another vice president there at the time, he raised his hand, and this is what I was told about. He says, "Hey, wait, Deke, you can't do that. That's 13 people." Now, this guy that said that was a very scientific kind of guy, and we became friends also, but I never could have believed he was going to be superstitious about 13. Anyway, Deke turns around and said, "Well, if we need to have 14, here'd be number 14. And that's when he laid down my resume and that kind of stuff. So I was number 14 that was selected in that group, and so 13 had to be a lucky number for me.
And quite an impressive group. I see you, just to name a few, Michael Collins, Eugene Cernan, Alan Bean, Buzz Aldrin. Quite an impressive group.
Well, there were some good guys and some mediocre guys, too. Of course, it's my personal opinion, but I was one of the better fighter pilots in the group, and certainly one of the few that was kind of oriented in the scientific area, being physics. I think I was the only physicist, and I was the only selection they got there that was working on a doctorate in physics at the time I was selected. Some years later, they started taking in physicists and medical doctors and the like. But at the time, I'd say it was a nice group. We had some qualified people. And at the time, that brought the whole astronaut group up to a total of 30. And they had selected 7 Mercury guys, and then what they call the Gemini group, that was 9, and then our 14, that was 30. And we fairly rapidly began to lose some of the people in aircraft accidents or the Apollo 1 fire where we lost three folks all at one time. That was spacecraft, first spacecraft accident. So it was fortunate that they had that many to start out with. And it was supposed to take us through the Apollo program. But because of some of the losses along the way, we included later selected people, probably I think three or four of them got included on Apollo.
Your original flight was supposed to be Apollo 2, if I remember correctly, and you were on the backup crew for Apollo 1. Is that correct?
Well, that's not a bad way to look at it, but if I could kind of put this in perspective for you, it must have been after 2 years, and I just started to select some of our guys to be included with launches with some of the first two groups of people. That was the Gemini program that was going on. And I didn't get selected there. It was getting towards the end of Gemini. And I think either three or four of our guys were able to participate in the Gemini program. And I tell you, I went in and I talked to Wally Schirra at the time, and I said, because he was kind of in charge of some of the astronauts there, and I said, Wally, he says, you know, what's the deal? It's been 2 years, and I've still not selected. He says, well, don't worry about it, because you're going to be surprised here in a couple of days. So it turns out that they did announce that I was on a space crew with Wally Schirra and Don Eisley, and that was going to be the second manned Apollo launch, which was a nice position to be in. And the first Apollo launch included Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. And Roger Chaffee was part of our group, too. But that was he was substituting in there for Mike Collins, because Mike had a physical problem he was dealing with. But in any case, here we were. We started off. We were going to be the second Apollo mission that flew. And after about 7 months of working and practically living out at North American Rockwell, where they were making the spacecraft, it was the first time they'd been participating in the space program. And so we had lots of fixes and lots of delays in the schedule as a function of that. And we were all concerned about the delays because we were, of course, committed to landing a man on the moon before the decade was out. So here it was. It was in 66. We had been on the crew from beginning of the year in 66. And now it got down to like August, September. They canceled out second Apollo mission there, and when they did that, we were assigned to be the backup crew for Apollo 1, and that's because our two spacecraft were nearly identical, and we'd been training on it, obviously, for 8 months. So while we were doing that, Apollo 1 was working forward to the first launch. We would have been backup, and hopefully, we thought at the time, about four missions later, that we would have been the prime crew on it. But unfortunately, the Apollo 1 crew was killed in a fire on the pad. It was a set of circumstances that was unusual and not repeated after that, but there were some problems with the Apollo 1 spacecraft, and they were doing a test on the ground, 100% oxygen, which meant it was at about 15.7 or 16 psi. That's a lot of oxygen. So anyhow, they died in a fire on the pad about 2 weeks later, I think it was, we got assigned the first crew then. So we had been the second crew, then we'd been on the backup crew for one, and now we were going on the first crew. And we set out to fix anything that might have been any kind of a problem. And boy, 21 months later, we launched as the first crew on the Apollo spacecraft to go into orbit.
You are listening to Cosmic Perspective Radio. I'm your host, Andy Pinheiros. We're going to continue our discussion with Apollo 7 astronaut Colonel Walter Cunningham, beginning with the tragic fire that took the lives of Apollo 1 astronauts and the first manned mission after the tragedy, Apollo 7. Would it be okay if I talk a little bit about the accident with you?
Oh, sure. Here, no problem. I'll help if I can.
I'm sure you had developed a relationship with Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee being backup. Can you tell us a little bit about them personally?
Well, Gus was one of the first Mercury astronauts. Ed White was part of the second group of astronauts, and one of the better qualified ones, I think. And Roger Chaffee was one of our group, the third group of astronauts. And they were living with a spacecraft, just like we were, out at North American Rockwell. But spacecraft, at that time, a lot of the changes we tried to get in were operational inputs. And North American had been used to developing and testing aircraft. And essentially, they had the main authority in what was going on, and so they wouldn't listen too well to astronauts at that time. They felt like we were exceeding our role in there, which was not the case. And so as we were getting close to launch, they said 30 days after this fire, there was going to schedule launch. Well, we, the flight crews, the astronaut office, we knew that that was unrealistic. It was not going to be going 30 days, but that's still what's listed as it. And they were having a test of operations of the spacecraft systems. It was not going to be taking very long to do that. The night before the Apollo 1 fire, Wally Schirra, Don Eisley, and I were performing that test, testing out spacecraft systems with the external power attached. But there was a big difference. The external power was plugged in with a hatch open, and so we were basically operating in normal atmosphere. And the test that we had to do, it only took us about 15 minutes, and things worked from our perspective, you know, okay. But then they had to test that spacecraft where it was operating on its own power, internal power. So they hooked it up, had to close the hatch, and with the hatch closed, they were operating on 100% oxygen, which in spacecraft, in orbit, they did all that, but that was like 5 psi in orbit. That's the pressure. Well, when you do that and you are operating 100% oxygen here on the ground, then you're up to a little over 14.7 psi that you normally operate here, that you're breathing right today. And they closed the hatch, they locked it up, and then they put it at about 16 PSI, and communications was very bad. They were spent several hours in that spacecraft with everything being cooked up at about 16 PSI of 100% oxygen. And when they got the fire started, they got a spark there from one of the wires. Unfortunately, we were exposed too much. And that was one of the concerns we had. But they got a spark, 20 seconds, and the crew was dead, actually. And they tried to get the hatch open even during that 20 seconds and couldn't do it because the hatch opened from the inside. So it had pressure against it. It had 16 PSI pressure against it. Couldn't get anything done with it. So we went to a different kind of hatches that they had been working on before that. It's public at large probably doesn't realize it, but we had been working on a hatch that opened outwards on it. So the crew was killed. We couldn't figure out exactly where the spark was, so they've got, you know, some opinions that they put down about it, but it was a bad accident and it probably shouldn't have happened. And so we set out to fix whatever we could. Well, we started fixing the things that had been related with causing the fire, which took some time, and that meant that we were able to get a lot of the changes that we were trying to make for operational activities. And for our instruments there, you know, like, for example, just little loops on the instrument panel there to keep you from bumping a switch accidentally, things like that. So we were able to get, I think they made changes before our flight of, I think it was 1,040 changes of one kind or another. Some were kind of trivial and some were pretty important changes. And of course, delays in the schedule gave us time to get the hatch in that we opened from inside. We were inside, but the hatch opened out. And so if you had any little extra pressure there like they did on that fire, it would even help blow it out. And we'd been trying to get that done before, but it now had total acceptance on it. And they fixed whatever they could, and we had operational things changed inside on some of our settings because there was a delay anyway. at the time that they had the accident, we were very concerned about the schedule to beat the Russians to the moon by the end of that decade. And yet, you know, we had all this, we fixed all those things. 21 months later, we launched from that site what was, it was called Apollo 7 now. That was not seven flights later, it was like three flights, unmanned flights later. But that's how the numbering was going. And so we lifted off after 1,000 changes and 21 months of delay. And the spacecraft turned out to be a wonderful shape, considering everything. And to this day, it's still the longest, the most ambitious, the most successful first test flight of any new flying machine.
And you accomplished all your objectives, I believe, during the mission. You must have had quite a few, particularly after the fire, and then what was to come next?
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of objectives, many of them, you know, for the mission. And the mission was scheduled for 11 days, well, just 10.8 days. And we were going so smooth on that, which was a surprise to people on the ground, but they ended up adding four more mission objectives during the flight. And when we completed things, and there was one or two of those we didn't really get finished with, but because they'd added them on, we were declared 101% successful. And it's still the longest, most successful mission.
I would like to ask you this question. If Apollo 7 had failed, what do you think might have happened to the U.S. space program?
Well, if Apollo 7 had failed also, it's kind of questionable whether we would have continued to try to have the Apollo program to land a man on the moon. I can't say for sure. But by now, we would have definitely been in there. The Russians had failures, and they continued to work. And certainly, we should also. So I'd like to think that we would, we just had more delays. There's a good chance that that would have cost us beating the Russians to the moon. The Russians had one problem after another, and they had some failures in their booster that they were trying to launch to get to the moon. So they didn't even admit that they were in that race until at least 10 or 12 years later.
Would it be okay if I talk a little bit about Wally Schirra?
Sure.
Some say that he had a cold on the Apollo 7 mission. Some say that he had an attitude, and some people say that he was trying to prove a point.
I think all three of those things you mentioned are correct. First off, let me tell you this. Wally Schirra was one of the better aviators that I flew with at NASA. He was a good test pilot and a very capable guy there. But he also had an ego that I guess caused some problem. I don't know if it caused him or how before, but you see, Wally's dad had been an admiral in the Navy. Wally was a captain. Wally's grandfather had been an admiral in the Navy, and Wally was very supportive of what he considered the regular philosophy of the Navy, that whoever is in command of the vessel, whether it's an aircraft carrier or just a cruise ship, even the captain is in control of everything. So that egotism showed itself out when Wally was in orbit with us on Apollo 7. He had flown a Mercury mission. He'd flown a Gemini mission, short, incidentally, I think 24 hours on the Gemini mission, and it didn't show up as much. So in orbit, that was a problem. Unfortunately, the ground thought, or at least some of the people down there, thought that we were behaving the same way, which was not correct. Anybody can go back and check that. I certainly never had any kind of conflict with the ground. But that delayed Wally a bit. He had a cold, and he was not able to participate in a lot of things, really, for the first couple of days. Eventually, he came back, and we ended up doing the full 11 days. And Wally had his conflicts with the ground, not big, obvious things, but to those of us that were around, we could tell it happening. And that caused a problem, really, for all of us. Wally had a cold, and that cold started showing up, really, right after he got in orbit. I never had a cold, in spite of what Wally insisted on telling to the ground. He didn't want the ground to think that he was worse off. And Isley, I can't say, had a cold either. He coughed a little bit maybe the first day, but Isley didn't have a cold. So that caused a problem. air-to-ground communications. It didn't affect how successful we were, because regardless of what was going on with any of us, we were committed to doing the job, whatever it was.
Do you think that Wally Schirra's actions kept you from further opportunities or future opportunities with Apollo missions?
Oh, I think it's possible that impacted future career. I think that was one of the factors, maybe. But the other factor is, I think that since I was considered a civilian, I went to work for NASA as a civil servant because I was not on active duty. So they considered me a civilian. In reality, I might be the only one that maintained my reserve activities while I was at NASA as a civilian. So that was part of an impact. They may have been thinking of me as a scientist astronaut, although I had not completed my doctorate yet. But I'm sure that there was a fair amount of impact based on Wally's behavior with the ground. And it's a shame. Wally was a good pilot. Just had a bad attitude, unfortunately.
But as you said, you know, Apollo 7 was an incredibly successful mission, an incredible transition mission. And only 21 months later, NASA launched Apollo 7. It was very successful. And in the very next flight, Apollo 8 orbited the moon and came back to the Earth. Amazing, the transition and the importance of Apollo 7.
Well, Apollo 8 was not originally considered going out to the moon. Apollo 8 was going to be flying a mission pretty much like ours, except that they were going to be going out to about 8,000 to 12,000 miles away from the surface. And that was a different kind of operation than we'd ever had up until that time. But hopefully they were trying to have the lunar module, which was not ready yet for them either. It's a pretty complicated story as how they switched over, because they didn't really switch over until after our mission. But they began training about 8 weeks before their launch. They started training for a flight out to the moon and back. And NASA, at the time, the operational people were all trying to get approval for that as a mission. That wasn't approved and endorsed and really signed up for until about 2 weeks after we landed. They committed then Apollo 8 to make that mission. But for at least the last 8 weeks prior to that time, Apollo 8 had been training for that mission and what the significance were of things like that, and how to go into lunar orbit and then come out of lunar orbit and come on back. So the Apollo program turned out to be really successful. The commitment was to land a man on the moon, and we were all committed to that. And we did it in 5 missions. I would suspect that before the first mission, even after Apollo 1 and that fire on the pad, I would think the general feeling was that we may very well have lost one mission, one crew, prior to landing successfully on the moon. Didn't happen. Operations were wonderful. Ground control was wonderful. You look at Apollo 13, which had the explosion on the way to the moon and back. They operated wonderfully. So I think it was a very, very successful program, Apollo was.
You're listening to Cosmic Perspective Radio with today's guest, Apollo 7 astronaut Colonel Walter Cunningham. We'll be back in a few minutes to discuss Neil Armstrong and the Apollo 11 moon landing and the future of manned space exploration. This is Cosmic Perspective Radio. We're back to continue our discussion with Apollo 7 astronaut Colonel Walter Cunningham. We are now closing in on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 landing on the moon. You were friends with Neil Armstrong. I kind of wondered, you know, we had the new movie out, The Last Man. Your feelings on the portrayal of Neil Armstrong in that movie?
Well, I kind of enjoyed the movie if I thought of it as just a Hollywood affair. But the Neil Armstrong that they had in First Man was not the Neil Armstrong that we knew. Of course, we didn't know everything about his personal family life, but they made it look awfully negative. But he was a very, very capable, operational fellow there in the office or everything else we did. I can't imagine anybody really doing any better job, as a matter of fact. And also, the movie, unfortunately, when Hollywood gets a hold of it, they got to try to make everything look more complicated than it is, worse than it is. So everything on the spacecraft or even the X-15 out there, it was exaggerated. So they were all handled better than you saw in that movie. But the movie itself, I thought, was worth seeing. And unless you've had some experience back there, like I have, I don't think you would have many complaints about that movie. But I don't know any of our guys that felt like it was really accurate.
Just from being part of the public, looking at Neil Armstrong, he seemed to be a very private person. But other people that I've talked to said he was a very social person, too, just that he was private in his life at times.
Well, he was, and he kept his life private. But whatever the job required, he was very capable at it. I never found him being unfriendly or anything else. In fact, I think he was a very friendly, respectful kind of guy. And so we were pleased to have Neil there. Boy, were we. I felt fortunate to be sharing my activity with him.
Everyone I've spoken to on the Apollo program told me that Neil Armstrong was the right choice for the first lunar landing.
I think he was. I think he was the right choice. It's not that the other people, none of the others could have done it, because I guarantee you that every one of us, if we had that job, we wouldn't have lifted off until we thought that we could really do it. But as you're looking at it from the outside there, I don't think they could have done any better than get Neil to do that.
Is it true that after Neil Armstrong's accident, his near-death accident on the lunar lander trainer, that he actually went back to work in his office to do paperwork afterwards?
the movie makes that one look pretty bad, and he's all kind of scarred up. My office was right next door to Neil's, and Alan Bean was in my office. I don't remember what we were talking about at the time, but we think we called flight ops. They said that Neil had to eject because of the failure in the lunar landing trainer. And I says, no, it couldn't have happened. He's here in the office right next door. And I said, yes, it did. So Alan and I, we stuck our head in there. And there was Neil sitting down going through his paperwork and filling some stuff out. And we had to check with him to confirm that, yes, he had ejected about an hour earlier.
Certainly he was that type of person. I have to believe that all of you were. You'd have to be to take those kind of risks and achieve those kind of goals.
Well, I do think that you had to be comfortable sticking your neck out about things. And that's why you couldn't even apply unless you were a fighter pilot and or test pilot at the time. And that's why I look back on my career as the most important thing that's happened to me was being a Marine Corps fighter pilot when I was very young, right out of high school, and what the pluses were. But those of us that were there for those days of the space program, I think probably almost all of us from the time we were kids wanted to be a pilot.
I'd like to talk about the future of the space program. NASA's planning to go back to the moon with the help of commercial companies. Your thoughts on the U.S. going back to the moon with commercial companies helping out?
Okay, well, talking about NASA and the future, the thing we need to keep in mind, unfortunately, is NASA, like all government agencies, actually, as time goes on, they became more bureaucratic. There's probably several layers of management now between the head of NASA and the astronaut office. Back in the time when I was there, we could pick up the phone and talk to the head of NASA. And I can never forget some of the guys. Even they called the president's office for one thing or another. I don't know what. I never did that. But we had a different role, and because of it caused some operational problems for NASA as well, for the people that we were working with, they started laying more control and leaving astronauts with less of a role in it. But as all the hardware became much more operational, they didn't need that kind of input. You know, we were involved in the design and the construction and the testing of spacecraft in those days. Today, they're not. They're also, the agency itself is not nearly as well funded as it was back then. The numbers look like they're bigger, but as a percentage of the national budget, they're not. It was just one year back in the 1960s where NASA had 4% of the national budget that one year. Today, the NASA budget is about 0.4% of the national budget. And they're had some more bureaucratic layers on it. And we've had private industry has started their efforts in the space program. And it's a good thing that they have. I didn't get terribly optimistic about them for a couple of years, but now they seem to be doing pretty well. They operate much more inexpensive than NASA does. So NASA is fortunate that they've got some of those companies out there now that are doing it. Will there be some failures? Yes, there probably will be some failures. But in the long run, I think it's going to work out pretty good. Now, what are we doing in our program? Well, they talk about going to Mars. Talk about going back to the moon. I haven't been able to find any real metal support myself for establishing humans living on Mars. We have a lot of things to overcome that people don't talk about in it to enable man to even fly a spacecraft out there to Mars and come back. Landing and returning, I'm not in support of that. But in order to do those things, we'd be better off establishing a base on the moon, whether it's on this side or the back side of the moon, learning how to have operations that far away. And that's a pretty long shot, too, to do that. And it's also not inexpensive. So we're going to have to be dependent on private industry. And going to the moon and establishing a facility makes sense to me to develop operational capability. And it's questionable as to whether we will or will not go to Mars. There are things that we can learn about the moon. I do not see going to the moon in order to produce fuel, things like that, that would then carry us on out to Mars. But we'll keep pushing along those lines, but it will slow down. It's been 50 years since we landed man on the moon. And that's not unusual when you look at the history of countries and how frequently they stick their neck out and move to the next frontier. So it'll take a while for us to do that.
What would you suggest to people that would like to be astronauts someday? What recommendations would you give them?
Well, as I look at not just the space program, but our society and our culture has changed over the years. I'm one of those people that believes, and I will tell the young people today, you've got to be willing to stick your neck out to get ahead. Don't count on others to make you a success all the time. I'm also one of those people that doesn't think that everybody is equal in anything or that everybody has to have the same equal outcome. What they need is equal opportunity. And you are going to get to where you can within that if we have the right attitude. And even if you find yourself losing there at the beginning, that might encourage you to then perfect yourself and do better. So we need to get back to where it's a competitive kind of existence growing up. In the space program today, it's different than what you need to be as a scientist. They take the scientists up there and they spend a long time up there and they're doing scientific work on it. That appeals to a different group of people maybe than just all the military pilots. You don't have to be a pilot these days. In fact, I think less than half of the people that are there have any military flying experience. So our world is changing. Believe me, everybody is not equal in the outcome. What you need to have is equality in the opportunity. Everybody should have the opportunity to improve themselves.
I ask this question to astronauts when I interview them, and I'd love to ask you it, and that is, when you look up at the moon, do you have any thoughts?
No. People do ask that these days because it seems so remote to them. It doesn't seem remote to us at all. They also ask you, invariably, they ask you when you get waiting there for launch, when you're in the spacecraft, were you afraid? They have a hard time understanding when you say, no, we knew that our next was at risk every once in a while, but we felt confident that we could handle them. We also knew that there comes some time when you might not. But the attitude in the public at large, unfortunately, is changing in some ways. To me, it doesn't look better than it did.
One thing that I recall in other interviews with Apollo astronauts and other astronauts, they say the thing they're most concerned about is not messing up. They don't want to do something that they shouldn't have done or forgot something that would affect the mission. But they say as far as fear goes, it's a daily job, basically.
Right, Right. And I miss it. I miss being a fighter pilot and flying airplanes all the time. Because even if we were still at NASA, it'd be years between missions into space. But I dearly loved that T-38 and still maintaining my 30, 40 hours about it.
I believe you said in an interview that test pilots and fighter pilots have said that they've cheated death. Do you feel that way, being a fighter pilot and astronaut?
Do fighter pilots cheat death?
Yeah.
I don't think that they cheated death, but I think they were fortunate sometimes in not dying. And you've got to be willing to stick your neck out. And when you do, there is a chance that that can happen. And if anybody read my book, The All-American Boys, they'll find several places I mentioned in there where I could have ended up being out of it. But the real thing is how you handle these things psychologically so that that strengthens you and helps you on your commitment instead of weakening you or feeling like you can't take the risk or what have you. Believe me, I'm almost 87 now, and my life would not have been what it was had I not been willing to stick my neck out.
Colonel Cunningham, it's been a real honor to have you with us today on Cosmic Perspective Radio. Thank you for being part of the great American dream, sending a man to the moon and or men to the moon and returning them safely to the Earth, what I consider to be mankind's greatest achievement. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and I agree with you. That has been mankind's greatest achievement to date.
Colonel Cunningham, you mentioned your book. Do you have a website that listeners can go to learn more about you and your book?
My website is waltercunningham.com. And there's something on there about the book, but Amazon, you can get the book at Amazon. It's still selling 41 years after I wrote it.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Poneros production.